Welcome to the Food, Family and Friends Podcast, proudly presented by worldpodcasts.com. Now it's time to join your host, Vanessa Baxter.
Okay, this is the beginning of the interview with Glenn Shackloth. Okay, hey Glenn, lovely to have you here on my podcast.
Yeah, nice to be here, Ness.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to interviewing you. So you are obviously married to my husband's sister, and we've hung out for many years.
And cooked many times.
And cooked many times together. So I'm really, really excited about interviewing you. And the reason for interviewing you is that I think that our listeners will find it really fascinating to hear your stories as an abalone diver and to understand. And I don't even know, how on earth did you become an abalone diver? And, you know, a little bit about what that means and a little bit about the world of abalone and how your real interest in cooking came about, because I know you really actually love to experiment and to cook. Hmm. So just share a little bit of, yeah, where did you start? Did it start with your family? Is it something that you knew you wanted to do, or how did it all begin?
Well, it all began by growing up on the water near Bruny Island, in a fishing community overlooking the water, close to a main boat ramp that was one of the main abalone diving launch ramps, and very close to a fishing wharf where a lot of the abalone boats unloaded. And your listeners will be familiar with Pawa and the history of that industry, and we're just across the Tasman, and it's a very similar industry, a very similar product. And so I grew up watching divers go out, and I grew up snorkeling. My dad was not a commercial fisherman, but a very, very enthusiastic recreational fisherman. And so we grew up fishing and eating fish. And I got my first snorkeling set when I was six, and I used to go out and get Angazi oysters for Dad, and we'd sit there and eat them on the boat ramp. And yeah, that just all unraveled from there, and I couldn't wait to get into that industry. But by the time I was old enough to dive, the industry had sort of reached a pretty financially prohibitive entry level. The licenses were, you know, skyrocketed in the 80s into the hundreds of thousands, and finally peaked out at about 11 million for a license. So it became became prohibitive to enter the industry. It was only when they sort of broke the licenses down into units and diving entitlements that you were able to sort of lease them. External people were able to lease licenses, and that gave me the opportunity to get involved. 20 years later, I've dived all around Tasmania, Bass Strait Islands, King Island, Flinders Island, Hogan, Deal, and everywhere in between. And in the process, got to cook and experiment with a lot of abalone. So we grew up cooking fish. We'd go floundering at night and come in and have flounder for breakfast. And in those days, it was old wooden boats, and we'd be out there with balaclavas in the winter and kerosene lamps and dodgy old flounder lights. And and we'd come in and have these fish breakfasts, which, you know.
Yum.
Yeah.
And how did you cook it? Did you just cook it? Did you just
throw it in the pan? Throw it in the pan with a bit of butter and in those.
Lemon.
Yeah, in those days, there was no gourmet olive oil. It was just butter and lemons and garlic. So very simple, and I, you know, you really can't go wrong. Mm. Get back to the basics. You just can't go wrong. Work on taste and simplicity and stay in that zone. Experiment around that, and you can't fail.
Yeah. Well, did your dad actually? Did he just did diving and snorkeling and stuff for fun?
Dad never dived. He only fished. He only ever line fished. He was a trout fly fisherman, like an angler. He was a really enthusiastic angler. So he saltwater fished and freshwater fished brim and trout and ocean fish as well. But he never dived.
Right.
I was the first diver in the family.
Okay. And did he cook or did mum cook?
Oh no, he cooked fish. Yeah, but mum cooked everything else, but dad cooked fish.
Dad cooked the fish.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And did your mum love food, or was it about simple cooking for her and keeping everything? Because you've got quite a few siblings, haven't you?
Yeah, no, I've got a couple of brothers, and grew up in a family of five boys, so took a bit of feeding. And mum, we had a big big block of land where the house, where our house is and or was and where we grew up, and it was an agricultural, used to be an apple orchard area, so it was very fertile land, and we had a massive back garden. Mum was a mad keen veggie gardener, so we had the backyard was like a Chinese market garden. Crops rotated, and we had no choice. We had to, you know, weed garden beds and pick peas and fruit and various things when they were ripe and ready to be processed. And Mum froze, bottled, made jam, you name it, she did it. And we ate fresh product when it was available, or frozen, or preserved when it wasn't fresh.
So a typical country, an Aussie country upbringing. Yeah, it sounds like
with lots of fresh fish.
It was good. Yum! Yeah. Sounds great. So just a little bit backpedaling on what you were saying about the expense of getting into the industry as a diver. Did that come about because of the restrictions on the amount of abalone that could be taken for people? I mean, what was it about?
Well, Tasmania is the biggest single wild abalone fishery in the world. Combined with the other states in Australia, we make up 50% of the world's global wild abalone harvest. So Tasmania's 25% of the world's wild abalone harvest. So
it's a lot for a small little place.
Yeah, it's a significant influence on the global market. So that the Tassie industry could influence the market. So when the market would try and, you know, push the price down, or the divers just stopped going to work and wait till the price came up, they just sit tight until the price went up, and then they'd unload again. So they had the benefit of a significant influence, to the point where they could actually influence the global beach price. So
wow.
And the fact that they had the volume and the influence, I guess it just, you know, and as other countries fished out their resources, it left us in a pretty good position. In the past, we, you know, we're in a very good position. I can't say that's the case now, tragically, but it's not the healthy fishery it used to be.
And as an abalone diver, how did that work for you? Do you know, did you dive all day, every day, you know, or all day for a few hours all year round? You know, what does the life of an abalone diver look like?
Well, you just work around the seasons and the weather, and the Tasmanian industry is broken into six zones. We've got east, west, central, west, north, and then we've got Bass Strait and Greenlip. Have I covered them all?
Yep.
Yeah. Greenlips are found around King and Flinders and around the northeast and northwest tips of Tassie. The Bass Strait abs are a lot smaller. They're like the Victorian abs. And then you come down the west coast, you've got your big abs, really big abs, and then along the south coast, and then east coast varies in condition and size average, depending on the areas. So you'd fish the different zones. Each quota unit's broken into six components. So you would secure a package, for argument's sake. Some divers wouldn't do Bass Strait or Greens. Others would specialise in those zones because they had access or lived in those areas. So, but for me, I've worked in most zones over the 20 years. But typically, I would, you know, get a package of Norths and do a run up north. Get a package of Greens. Do a trip to King or Flinders. And while I was there, I'd get a package of Bass Strait Blacks and try and bowl a couple of ton of those over while I was there to justify the trip. But typically, you know, you'd work the weather. If you had west coast weather, you'd work the west. If you had east coast weather, you'd work the east. And typically, you would work the west in summer when the summer patterns, easterly patterns come through. And then in the winter months, you'd typically work the east coast. And Flinders Island. So you just dodge around. You've got your months and seasons that typically suit the different zones, and you try and line your packages up and get those fish caught as quickly as efficiently as you can.
And do you dive in pairs?
Sometimes. Sometimes you're on your own.
Sometimes you're on your own.
You always have a deckie, but it's more productive, economically productive, to work on your own, because you know two divers will probably, one diver will catch the same abs two divers will, and you don't have to share them.
Right.
You might whip them up a bit more efficiently because there's two of you, but it doesn't work out. It doesn't work out that well. So you're sometimes better off working alone. But if you're around the coast on a big boat, you've only got a short weather window, you might go around with another diver and help each other. You might only have a few fish to catch, and he might have heaps, and you might go around and just help him finish off.
So there's what his quota is.
Yeah, just help him, and then he'll help you finish off yours in a different zone. I think, you know, you have all different arrangements and different groups of people you work with and different, different arrangements.
Mm. Yeah. So did it live up to your dreams? Like, as a little boy, that's what you saw?
Oh,
you
yeah.
saw these divers come back, and that's what you wanted to be?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that, you're thrilled that's what you did? Is that, ticked the box?
Oh, yeah, no, it was just a totally awesome
experience.
20 years, loved it. I'd still be doing it I'd keep doing it if I could. You get old and the fish get harder to catch, and the great whites seem to be getting thicker every year.
They do seem to be getting a bit thicker, don't they?
Yeah. It's all getting too hard for an old bloke.
I don't think you're that old. I can't wait to put the photo up on the on the web page for this, and people will be like, old? What is he talking about? could you describe for us the difference, if you can, between a Pawa from New Zealand and the Aussie abalone?
Well, I've never been to New Zealand, but I know several Tassie divers who have been over there and worked in New Zealand, and I understand the Pawa is very closely related to abalone. Is a smaller, darker coloured meat.
Yeah, it's definitely darker.
Yeah, and I've never eaten them, so I can't really judge the texture or the flavour, but I understand that the market favours the lighter coloured meat.
So which market are we talking about? Who is it that is mostly eating abalone?
All of Asia, but predominantly China.
Yeah. So the majority of abalone caught in Australia would go to China?
Correct.
And why do they love it so much?
Well, it's a traditional food source and delicacy. And there's just so many Chinese people, you know, and there's more and more wealthy Chinese people who want to have premium products, particularly at traditional ceremonial times. It's just an insatiable market.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Do you know how they cook it? Do you know how they tend to like to eat it?
Yeah, I'm not, totally familiar with traditional Chinese cooking methods, although I do have Asian friends and I have eaten abalone with them. But I understand one of the preferred Chinese methods is to make stock or soup with the abalone, and obviously they do all sorts of frying as we would. Yeah, but I think I understand the soup. Abalone soup is a big one for Asian cultures, particularly with. I understand it's been a traditional thing to make abalone soup for their pregnant women and young children. I don't know how cultural or how that culture has played out in recent decades, but I understand that was a major part of their culture in the past with the coastal communities would use abalone to support pregnancy.
Mm, that's really interesting. Mm. Yeah. So in New Zealand, the Pawa, the most probably seen way to eat it, you know, for the non-fisherman, so for me, would be to buy a Pawa fritter, which is similar to a whitebait fritter. So this is very Kiwi to do a fritter with the seafood in it.
Mm.
And you go to markets and things and there are these food trucks and you can get a Pawa fritter. So I'm assuming they're banging that all the way down to get it really, really tender before it then goes in the fritter. That would be a very Kiwi traditional way to serve it.
Mm.
How about Australians? I mean, do Australians even eat abalone in general?
Oh, yeah.
So what would be the way that would an Aussie would tend to eat it?
Well, there's a whole bunch of different ways the Aussies prepare and eat seafood, and in this case, abalone. But it's come a long way. Like when we were kids, it was called mutton fish, and it was just a really, you know, the first ab divers that I became aware of had very rudimentary boats and equipment outfits. They were very basic, and they weren't making much money. And then, you know, it just ramped up and up and up. And in those days, that there was, you know, it was a meat and three veg culture, and eating a giant sea snail was not
on the agenda.
No, and then it became more popular and more popular, and now it's like everywhere else in the world, it's a delicacy and people love abalone, and they cook it in all sorts of refined ways. But and then you go back, there's still the classic Aussie, take it out the back and belt it with a cricket bat in a tea towel, and, you know, pulverize it and throw it onto the barbecue with all the meat juices and toss it around. And I'm not a fan of that method, but I've seen it done plenty of times. And right up to, you know, like your Kiwis do with their fritters, we have abalone patties, and
They're
typically put through a food processor or in the old days a hand mincer.
Yep.
To create abalone mince, and then that would be, you know, mixed with egg and flour and whatever else, and rolled into patties, and, you know, and cooked as your power fritters. And then we do similar things. We make abalone mince and roll it into spring rolls and deep fry.
Oh, yum.
Or little meatballs. Flatten them into little medallions, toss them around in a pan, drop them in a deep fryer. All sensational ways. But my favourite is to tenderise the abalone without actually damaging the meat.
Mm. So how do you do that?
I use a bit of framing timber rather than a meat mallet with rounded edges. Run the planer over it so you've got nice curves everywhere. So you're hitting the meat, rotating the meat so you don't miss anywhere, and so you've got no square edges, and you just gently hit the ab, or hard enough that it'd really hurt if you hit your finger, but not hard enough to break the meat, and just move your way around, rotate the ab as you tenderize it, and once you've done it a few times, you can identify when the meat's released. But it doesn't matter what you do after that; it'll be tender. But my favourite way is probably to trim all the outside off, cut it in half, trim about 2 or 3 mil off the foot, and then you're just left with two white pieces of meat.
Mm-hmm.
Throw all the offcuts in a pot with a bit of miso paste, spring onions, and a bit of wakame seaweed, and some shiitake mushrooms. Push that off to the side, bring it to the boil, simmer it, and just push it off to the side and let it simmer for a couple of hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then prep your abalone, do some sashimi for entree, do some pan fried for a second round of entree, and then put a few slices in a bowl prepared ready. Pull some of the shiitake mushrooms out of the soup, slice them up, put them in with the ab slices. Get the stock, strain the stock off, get it back to boiling, and then ladle the boiling stock over the mushrooms and abalone meat. Throw some sprinkles, spring onions
on top,
and a bit of coriander, and can't go wrong.
Three courses.
Yeah.
Yum. Yeah. Sounds divine.
Mm, works really well.
Mm, sounds divine. And ideally you'd be slicing the abalone thinly for all of those ideas anyway, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you can. But once you've tenderised it, doesn't matter what you do.
Okay.
You can cut it like to 2 or 3 mil thick and just falls apart.
How do you think in the very, very beginning people knew to pull this weird flipping thing out of the ocean, to cut it loose from its shell, and then know that they had to tenderize it? Or I guess it was inedible until you had, so people then banged it to see if that would work. Is that?
I don't know. I reckon the Asian cultures have had God knows how many thousands of years to work it out.
Yeah. It's amazing though, isn't it?
Yeah. And the Aboriginals here used to just pull them out of the water and throw them in the throw them in the fire
into
in their
the
shell
embers.
And let them cook in their own juices in the shell. I've never done that, but I've...
Oh, that's quite cool.
Yeah, but I've done it with scallops, works fine, but I've never tried it with an ab. I will one day, but yeah, I'm not...
So if you're not diving for them anymore, or can you, now that you're not a commercial diver, can you dive anyway and collect some just for family use? Are you allowed a small amount like they are in New Zealand?
Yeah, you're allowed to get 10 on any given day, and you're allowed a maximum of 20 in your possession at any given time, provided you've renewed your recreational dive license.
Right. Okay, so you can still enjoy them.
Yeah, for $50 a year, you can go and get 10 abs any given day.
Okay, yeah. And do your kids enjoy eating ab?
They love it, yeah. They'll enjoy diving and hunting for them, and they enjoy cooking and eating them. One daughter prefers sashimi. She's eaten sashimi abalone all her life, and Kylie loves it. We all love abalone and eat it at every opportunity still.
Yeah, well, I always love cooking seafood with you, Glenn, because you're very experimental with your cooking, aren't you? You just kind of like make it up as you go along and taste things as you go, and if it tastes great, then you move ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. Just when you've got some product at your disposal, you can experiment, and you're away on boats for long periods of time around the coast. Nothing like messing around and experimenting with a new dish.
Yeah. And have you met lots of chefs along the way through your diving?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, most divers are really good cooks because we spend a long time away from home and work hard and play hard and like to eat well. So everyone I know knows how to cook pretty well.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, I do enjoy cooking with you because it's always good fun experimenting, and then everyone around us seems to quite enjoy what we produce, so it's always a bonus as well.
It's always fun.
It is always fun, absolutely. Have you got a favourite cuisine from around the world? Have you got a particular favourite? Or
probably Japanese.
Yeah. Japanese, yeah. Okay. Yeah, which isn't surprising considering the amount of seafood you eat, and it's all very clean and fresh, isn't it? Clean, fresh flavours. So.
I'd have to say Japanese.
Yeah, Japanese is pretty good. Mm. And how about... your kids love your Japanese as well, don't they? Because they're always wanting to go and have sushi.
I got them spring-loaded chopsticks when they were babies, so they
got used to using them.
Yeah, now they're very adept at managing Asian cuisine and chopsticks.
Excellent, excellent. So we are being heralded. We've kind of got these little people's faces staring at us from the other room, and our mother-in-law, our mutual mother-in-law, saying it's time to come for dinner.
We better wrap it up.
So we need to wrap it up. So before I let you go, I'm going to ask you some either-or questions, and normally I have these prepared and written down, but I haven't, so I'm not sure whether we'll get to the 10, but I'm just going to think of some on the spot. Okay, so are you ready?
Fire away.
All right. Pasta or rice?
Rice.
Stone fruit or berries?
Stone fruit.
Red wine or white wine?
Red wine.
Butter or olive oil?
That's a tough one. I'll go with olive oil.
Oh, lime or lemon?
Either or, but I'll go with lemon.
Really? Okay. Do you like things spicy or mild?
Spicy.
Do you like cake or cookies?
Cake.
Do you like crackers or bread?
Crackers.
Okay. Do you, what can I say? Okay, so I've got a tricky one now. Do you prefer scallops or prawns?
Prawns.
Prawns, okay. And I can't think of any more because I know we're going to be bugged to go and have dinner. But thank you so much. It was so much fun to interview someone that I know pretty well. So thanks for sharing your story.
Pleasure, Ness. Look forward to cooking again.
Yeah, me too. All right, let's go have dinner.
Cheers.
So here I am in Melbourne Central, and I'm wandering through one of the laneways that has become quintessentially Melbourne scene, actually. It's amazing. There's little cafes all through what used to be really derelict laneways between massive buildings. So now as you wander through, there's so many different varieties of places that you can eat. And it's packed all the time. It's insane. In fact, it just feels like it's the total hub of Melbourne. So what used to be a spot that no one would probably walk down between, maybe it was unsavoury, maybe it wasn't safe, is suddenly now where everyone is. And it really is an extraordinary, quirky scene. Most of the pull-down shutters that go over the shops when they close have actually been painted, spray-painted, and that has been supported by the government. So it looks really quirky and funky, and then in each of the little holes you've got different types of cafes. So I'm standing in front of one now, and it's called The Soup Place, and this is actually a really cool concept where you can get 3, 6, 9 different types of soup and some fabulous salads and things. But what it is as well is it's a pay it forward. So you pay $3.50 extra and you're helping to feed the homeless. And they've covered their walls in all these little stick-it notes. And the little post-it notes are from the people who have paid the $3.50. And it might say, you know, have a great meal, hope you enjoy, you know, this feed, or a smiley face, and that will go to the food that is provided for those who are homeless. It's such a cool concept. It's a great little spot, and they seem to be pretty busy lots of the time. So it's a really, really cool thing. It seems to be here from the big umbrella group. So we'll look them up on social media and see what they're all about. But it's certainly a fantastic concept. And then, you know, you've got Greek, you've got a Euro Lane, upstairs as well. So just above the shop fronts downstairs, I guess perhaps it used to be probably just storage rooms and things. So now there are really funky bars and things upstairs also. There's one here called Hell's Kitchen, which looks fantastic. It's late lunches and evenings, and it's licensed, and there's people sitting up at the tables looking down on the pedestrians walking along the lane. Seriously cool. And then there's juice places, breakfast places, corporate catering venues, and people just taking photos everywhere. People walking around, looking everywhere, not wanting to miss anything. Spray painted little alleys off the actual laneways. So you've got laneways to alleyways everywhere. And it's really quite extreme, because at the end of a little alleyway that's completely spray painted and people sitting around on bread crates and things, all of a sudden there's a plate glass window. And, you know, you're actually heading into an office block or a true retail space as we understand it. So it's a really, really funky concept. And, you know, well done, Melbourne, as always. Okay, now I've come into another laneway. This is sort of like gives the appearance of being a little bit more upmarket, I guess. This one, the cafes are a little bit more established looking, but you're still down a little laneway. There doesn't seem to be as much spray painting, but you still have people kind of out and about eating really gorgeous looking lunches and massive big open plan kitchen. So as you walk along the laneway, not only can you see the people eating, but you can see the chefs at the back cooking. Oh, here's some spray paint. So yeah, stop before I suggest that there are some that are upmarket and some that are downmarket. But I guess in some laneways the buildings have gone all the way to the bottom, so they haven't been able to open up. In fact, this laneway I'm heading straight into the Bourke Street Mall, where the Christmas lights and Christmas windows are still active in the Meyer building, which I'm heading towards now. And I'm going to take a brief break to go and check out the amazing Christmas windows of Meyer in Melbourne.
What's good? Ooh, 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 ooh. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Wow, this podcast, Food, Family and Friends, I am loving it. I hope you're loving it as much as I am. What fabulous guests we have on each week. It is just so inspiring talking to these people who are as equally as passionate about food and the relationships and the way food brings people together as I am. If you're after more during the week and you'd like to see some of our fabulous free blog tips and recipes, then head on over to our website, which is Food, Family FamilyFriendsPodcast.com. Also, there's a whole heap of other podcasts that you can listen to. You can have a look at the options on worldpodcasts.com. If you're here in New Zealand, then you can also head to podcasts.co.nz and see all the other fantastic podcasts that are up and running and due to launch in the very near future. It's so exciting to share with you. Thanks so much for coming along on the journey with us. It's awesome to have you all on board, and I can't wait to touch base with you again next week.
Food, Family and Friends Podcast, proudly presented by worldpodcasts.com.